background music. There it goes.
Happy New Year, everybody. Chat room, in the chat room, we've got a few, Iggy, Kel, Rabbi, welcome. Happy New Year to all. And it's interesting, Eliza, this, I mean, because I don't know if I told you this, but last New Year's morning, not this last one, 2013, but 2012, I woke up New Year's morning, and I, for some reason, I went straight to look outside. I don't usually do that. But 2012 New Year's morning, I walked out, I went out to my balcony, and I saw the Star of Islam. I saw a perfect crescent moon and a perfect star right there in my sky. It was right there. It was, and I had a bad feeling. And it was like God told me that there's going to be a rise of Islam. And
wow.
That's how 2012 started for me. So
This
New Year's morning, I saw no such thing, I'll have you know. I went out there, and the sky was beautiful, and there was a beautiful pink streak. It was even more beautiful than normal. There was a beautiful, dark pink streak because the sun hadn't come out yet, but there was absolutely no star in the sky, no crescent moon, and I said, amen. This is going to be, there's no bad omen in the sky this year, so I hope we'll have a good year.
Wow, that would be a scary start to the new year. Holy cats. Well, there is a lot going on in the news, but what I decided we should talk about is kicking off this year with what Islam is, where it comes from, a little bit of history, and some things we need to start thinking about early in the year, working on, working towards, getting engaged with. And from that perspective, I want to start out. There's a lot of information I want to share with you tonight in terms of Islam, the whole idea of Sharia, the definition of Sharia, how we can fight it, how we need to go about starting our work this year, because I'm kicking off a lot of activities with a group that I'm a part of, and I want to recommend that to everybody else here, because if we don't stand up now, as the song says, I won't back down. We need to move forward and get this thing going forward. So let me kick off with some articles I want to read to you about in terms of Islam in the United States. This is just a little bit of history about how it got started. Back in the 1880s to 1914, several thousand Muslims immigrated to the United States from the Ottoman Empire and from parts of South Asia. They did not form distinctive settlements and probably most assimilated into the wider society. Many of the slaves brought to colonial America from Africa were Muslims. It is estimated that 15 to 30% of the African slaves were Muslims. Once very small, the Muslim population of the U.S. increased greatly in the 20th century, with much of the growth driven by rising immigration and conversion, and a comparatively high birth rate. In 2005, more people from Islamic countries became legal, permanent United States residents, nearly 96,000, that's in 2005, than in any year in the previous two decades. In 2009, can we all figure out what 2009 time period
means? Oh, boy.
Means? Yeah.
Oh,
more than
Obama.
100, yeah. More than 115,000 Muslims became legal residents of the United States.
Oh.
Obama mania. Can we call Muslim mania? 115,000 became legal residents. A lot of the terrorists are legal residents, you know? So the history of Islam in the United States can be divided into two significant periods, the post-World War I period and the last few decades, although some individual members of the Islamic faith are known to have visited or lived in the United States during the colonial era. So let me continue on a little bit here. American views of Islam affected debates regarding freedom of religion during the drafting of the State Constitution of Pennsylvania in 1776. Constitutionalists promoted religious toleration, while anti-constitutionalists called for reliance on Protestant values in the formation of the state's Republican government. The former group won out and inserted a clause for religious liberty in the new state constitution. American views of Islam were influenced by favorable Enlightenment writings from Europe, as well as Europeans who had long warned that Islam was a threat to Christianity and republicanism. Now, between 1785 and 1815, over 100 American sailors were captive in Algiers for ransom. Several captivity narratives of their experiences that gave most Americans their first view of the Middle East and Muslim ways. And newspapers often commented on them. The views were generally negative. A Royal Tyler wrote The Algerian Captive in 1797, an early American novel depicting the life of an American doctor employed in the slave trade who becomes himself enslaved by the Barbary pirates. Finally, Presidents Jefferson and Madison sent in the Navy to confront the pirates and ended the threat in 1815, or so we could hope. Anyways, so that's a little bit of history of how Islam came to the United States. Some other stuff that I dug up that I found as well just blew my mind, that I could actually be sitting here in America all these years and not know anything about it. And it really just amazes me that I could be this stupid. Well, okay, a lot of people are this stupid. I woke up a few years ago. I am so glad I did, and I'm so glad I'm doing what I'm doing now, because I feel like I need to tell people all about it, where it's come from, and educate as many as I can. Lucha, had you heard anything about Winston Churchill and how he predicted some of this?
Oh, yes, I've seen part of his speech, and yes, I did, and it's interesting. I mean, he stood up to it, and he called it for what it was, and it's interesting you brought up Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates, because Islamists here in America, CARE will try to tell you that, you know, it's a big thing that, Congressman Keith Ellison swore his oath on Thomas Jefferson's Quran, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
They try to play it off like Thomas Jefferson. Well, you know, he was an enlightened man. He had a Quran. I mean, even way back then, there were Muslims here, and Thomas Jefferson had a Quran. Well, he only had one so he could know his enemy.
Right, right. Had to educate himself to figure out how to fight them. When he had read up on the... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to tell you to tell me about Winston Churchill, because I didn't know a whole lot about him.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Both him and his grandson, I found a couple of articles that they both wrote about this many years ago, but there's a professor and a former presidential speechwriter that wrote about Winston Churchill's predicting the future back November 30th, 1874. Is the birth date of, well, November 30th, 1874 is the birth date of the greatest statesman in history. Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Reagan deemed him so. Just his indomitable leadership in World War II, rallying a beleaguered Britain to triumph over Nazi tyranny, would alone earn him this unique distinction. Okay, this is, I'm reading a story from James C. Hume, so it's kind of his perspective on this, but it, let me go on. But the world is not aware that Churchill was a modern Nostradamus in his prophetic wisdom. Among other things, he predicted two world wars and the Cold War. Even today's headlines are stuff of predictions he made close to a century ago. 1905, he foresaw the creation of the Israeli state. Churchill was the first non-Jewish Zionist. 12 years before the Balfour Declaration, and I meant to look that up and I forgot to, sorry. In 1917, Churchill called for the Jewish state. It was not as if he represented New York's Lower East Side or Miami populated by Jews. Then in 1921, in a speech to the House of Commons, he spoke of a militant Islam sect, Wahhabis, more violent than any in history, which would kill their own sisters for wearing the wrong attire. This is 1921. These fierce zealots would terrorize the West with bomb-carrying jihadists who would burn embassies and destroy buildings by their passion to sacrifice their lives for guarantee of Islam heaven. Winston Churchill II would read his grandfather's, would read his grandfather's speech to President George W. Bush in the White House in 2007. If Churchill didn't exactly predict 9/11, he described its radical extremist perpetrators. So then President Nixon once told this James C. Humes that Churchill was the only leader who seemed to have a crystal ball. He had the mind of a historian and courage of a soldier. A scholar of history, he could see patterns replicating themselves. Like a soldier, Churchill would risk political death. This is the part that really, you know, impressed me. Churchill would risk political death by telling the people what they didn't want to hear. Spineless politicians or cover-your-ass bureaucrats will never state the ugly truth. Churchill, however, didn't worry about repercussions. He didn't talk in euphemisms or evasions. He delivered the unvarnished facts. 1921, he's giving us a prediction of the Islamists and what they want to do here. For those who ask what relevance Churchill's predictions have to today's world, they should keep in mind that he predicted the energy crisis in 1929. He warned that the West needed new sources of fuel to escape from being beholden to oiled oligarchies of the Middle East. And then in 1957, this writer heard Churchill state that the UN, this is even better, the UN was a feckless organization maimed by the congenital deformity, the Soviet veto, and that it is increasingly dominated by one-party autocratic states. One only has to note President Calderon, who stuffs ballot boxes and jails dissidents in Colombia while his country serves on the UN Human Rights Commission, or even worse, President Assad of Syria, who is slaughtering thousands of his citizens while his country joins Colombia on that Human Rights Commission that is attacking the U.S. for, among other things, using capital punishment and the many African Americans serving in prison. Wow. And apparently his grandson carried the message even to 2006. Churchill had such a background in this, was such a war hero, and eradicated the Hitler's regime. Gosh, is there any chance we can find another Churchill today? I don't know. I know there's so much out there that we need to be talking about in terms of today's world of politics, in terms of, fiscal cliff that's gotten averted. Isn't it great? Isn't it great? But I want to stay on Islam tonight. We are the Radio Jihad Network, and I'm going to stay on Islam tonight because this is something that I feel very passionate about. So I'm going to carry that forward in terms of trying to make sure everybody understands we've got a huge threat coming. Not coming, but here. It's here in so many forms, in so many fashions, in our government, and that's where I'm going to carry the message for the next couple weeks. I've got so much information tonight, might make this a two-parter. I'll take a breath and let Lucha talk because I don't want to hog the show, Lucha. I know you've got stuff to talk about as well. Then I'll kind of carry on with some of the grandson's information as well.
That's really good information, and I guess I was coming at it from a whole different perspective, which will actually complement what you're doing, so this is going to be a good show, because I went to the origins of Islam itself, and I found a really good article. Well, before I get into that, this one article breaks it down about, the true origins of Islam and Muhammad. Who really was good. Muhammad? Well, he was born around 570 A.D. in Mecca in Saudi Arabia. His father, Abdullah, died before he was born, and his mother, Amina, died when he was 6 years old. After the death of his grandfather, Abd al-Muttalib, Muhammad was raised by his uncle, Abu Talib, leader of the Banu Hashim clan. And there are three periods to Muhammad's life that they break down. Is the so-called prophetic period from 570 to 610 AD, the Meccan prophetic period, and then the Medinan prophetic period. And what I had never really realized, there was a lot about Muhammad's childhood that I didn't realize. He was working in the Meccan caravan trade, which put him in contact with diverse religious traditions. That's how he became familiar with Christians and Jews. And when he was 25 years old, he married a wealthy widow, Khadija, who was 15 years his senior. So, with more leisure time on his hands, he developed the habit of retreating to a cave on Mount Hira for prayer and reflection, as was common for the polytheists of the Meccan Quraysh tribe. He was what's known as a polytheist. He worshipped different gods like the rest of them did in his time. So here he is married to Khadija, who I'm not sure she wasn't demon-possessed herself. She had to have been. And, so we have him living in Mecca. This is the Meccan prophetic period is from 610 A.D. to 622 A.D. And Muhammad became convinced that a demonic spirit had ordered him to recite verses. These are what's called the satanic verses in Quran, Surah 96, 1-5. But Khadija, Muhammad was scared, and in this other article, it talks about him becoming demon-possessed. And you've got one of your, in Ibn Ishaq's The Life of Muhammad, this is one of the most trusted sources of stories about Muhammad that Muslims trust. This is what is written about Muhammad. These are comments from Muhammad's foster parents and those around him. Some months after our return, he and his brother were with our lambs behind the tents when his brother came running and said to us, now this is Muhammad that came running, or no, it's not. Two men clothed in white have seized that Qurashi brother of mine and thrown him down and opened up his belly and are stirring him up. We ran towards him and found him standing up with a livid face, or you could translate that as red face. We took hold of him and asked him what was the matter. He said, this is Muhammad, he said, two men with white raiment came and threw me down and opened up my belly and searched therein for I know not what. So we took him back to our tent. His father said to me, I am afraid that this child has had a stroke, so take him back to his family before the result appears. So we picked him up and took him to his mother, who asked why we had brought him, when I had been anxious for his welfare and desirous of keeping him with me. I said to her, God has let my son live so far, and I have done my duty. I am afraid that ill will befall him, so I brought him back to you as you wished. She asked me what happened and gave me no peace until I told her. When she asked if I feared a demon possessed him, I replied that I did. She answered that no demon had any power over her son, who had a great future before him, and then she told me how when she was pregnant with him, a light went out from her which illumined the castles of Bura and Syria. Now there's two things that they note in this passage, is that people around Muhammad believed that a demon was possessing him, and secondly, we are told that the beings physically threw Muhammad down to the ground. Now, when you go to biblical, demon possession in the Bible, what do the demons do to those they possess in the Bible? They throw them down to the ground. In Luke 9:42, it says, while he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. Now, nowhere in the Bible do real angels or heavenly beings possess people and physically throw them down to the ground in Scripture. All right, so there's in the authoritative Hadith, it's said, interestingly, there is Islamic material where Muhammad seems to have suffered from such demonic seizure-like spells and other similar convulsive behavior. Now, this is from a Hadith. This is from Ahmad B. Hanbal, The True Guidance, Part 4, An Introduction to Quranic Studies. So this is a Muslim-accepted writing. It says, the authoritative hadith, which means tradition, relate that Muhammad used to faint whenever revelation came to him. It is claimed he used to act like a drunkard. In his Bu, Al-Quran Al-Majid, Darwaza claims that Muhammad was taken out of this world. Abu Huraira says that, quote, whenever Muhammad received revelation, he was overwhelmed by trembling. Another account says he became distressed, foaming at the mouth and closing his eyes. At times he snorted like a young camel. Well, what does that sound like to you? That sounds like demon possession to me.
Yeah, really.
What does it sound like to you? I mean, does that not sound like demon possession? And these are the origins of Islam, and this is the so-called prophet that Muslims worship. What do you make of that? Does it sound like he was possessed, foaming at the mouth and his eyes rolling? That sounds like possession, Eliza.
Yeah, exactly. He's back then, I would have guessed that's what they would have assumed was going on with him, and how they can recognize that as a behavior to imitate is beyond me. The demonic stages of Islam, pure demonic, and I guess I've said it before, and I'm sorry I'm repeating it, it is not a religion, although I know Satanism is somewhat a religion, but it is not a religion. It's a political movement. And for anybody to want to imitate and practice that makes no sense to anybody that has any kind of sense of decency, honor, values. So it's amazing to me. It just, you know, I'm still in amazement on all of it when I learn this stuff. Back in 2006, I'm sorry, were you done with that, Lucha, or is there more?
Oh, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, 2006, when Winston Churchill III did a speaking engagement, I guess, in Raleigh-Durham, February of 2006, he maintained that the Islamic fundamentalism is as destructive as the malevolent isms of the 20th century, being Nazism, communism, and fascism. He spoke on February 10th at the John Locke Foundation anniversary dinner, and being the grandson, of course, of Winston Churchill, he referenced his grandfather's speech of 1921. But some of the things that he told them, basically, today, the new challenge, again, new being in 2006, I still wasn't awake. I don't know if, I'm wondering how many people were awake in 2006. Even by 2000, you know, with 9/11, we should have all woke up, I suppose. The new challenge as of 2006 in his speech was another ism, confronts us, that is the challenge of Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic Islam, declared war on the rest of the world as evidenced by the ruthless attacks across the globe, overwhelmingly targeted at innocent civilians. Besides the outrage of 9/11, the bombings in Madrid, in Bali, in London, and most recently, as of 2006, in Jordan. So, here he is even talking in 2006 of Winston Churchill's predictions, and he reads a little bit further into some of the speech of 1921, a large number of Saudi Arabia's followers belong to the Wahhabi sect, a form of Mohammedism which bears, roughly speaking, the same relationship to Orthodox Islam as the most militant form of Calvinism would have borne to Rome in the fiercest times of Europe's religious wars. The Wahhabis profess a life of exceeding austerity, and what they practice themselves, they rigorously enforce on others. They hold it as an article of duty, as well as of faith, to kill all who do not share their opinions and to make slaves of their wives and children. Women have been put to death in Wahhabi villages for simply appearing in the streets. Winston Churchill the first said this in 1921. His grandson references it in 2006. It's still happening today, 2013. What in blazes name is it that we are not doing right to stop this? Now, I would guess probably not until 9/11 did it start to happen worldwide. So probably it was happening all along in the Middle East, and gee, it's happening over there, so we don't need to pay attention. And I was guilty of that myself. The evil to that is that we needed to be paying attention. We needed to be alerting people. We needed to be educating people. We needed to be fighting it on their territory instead of ours. We let this slip through our hands, and I think a big part of it goes back to Jimmy Carter, when we didn't do anything to stop the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. In fact, we probably helped it. I'm not that deep into history to remember all of that, but I'm sure we did. All of this leads back to, really and truly, the behavior of Muhammad as well as the dictates of Sharia. Now, I'm going to go to their guidance, the reliance of the traveler. And when I look in the index for Sharia, it tells me to look for, sacred law. Sacred law. Well, sacred law equals Sharia law. So if I read from the reliance of the traveler, and it's 025.9, this is what Sharia law, sacred law, refers to. Authority in view of merit is that which is freely invested by the caliph through its own choice and entails delegating a given limitary function and the use of judgment within range of familiar alternatives. A lot of gobbledygook there. Let me continue. Reader's Digest form of this. This investiture consists of the caliph appointing an individual to independently govern a city or region with authority over all its inhabitants and discretion in familiar affairs for all matters of government, including seven functions, raising and deploying armies on the frontiers and fixing their salaries if the caliph has not already done so. 2, reviewing laws and appointing judges and magistrates. 3, collecting the annual rate, kiraj, from those allowed to remain on land taken by Islamic conquests, gathering zakat from those obliged to pay, appointing workers to handle it, and distributing it to the eligible recipients. 4, protecting the religion and the sacrosanct, preserving the religion from alteration and substitution. 5, enforcing the prescribed legal measures connected with the rights of Allah and men. Enforcing Allah's laws. Leading Muslims at group and Friday prayers, whether personally or by representative, facilitating travel to the Hajj for both pilgrims from the region itself and those passing through from elsewhere, that they may proceed to the pilgrimage with all necessary help. And 8, and if the area has a border adjacent to enemy lands, an 8th duty arises, namely to undertake jihad against enemies, dividing the spoils of battle among combatants and setting aside a 5th for deserving recipients. That is sacred law. So, Sharia is their way of finally getting the caliphate instilled everywhere. What I'd like to do a show on sometime in the future, Lucha, maybe we can do some investigation on that as well, is how did they stop the caliphate before? How did it get slowed down? How did it get eliminated back when the Ottoman Empire was there?
That's a good question. Was that during the time of the Crusades? That's a good question.
I think it's back in the 20s, 20s, 30s maybe. I don't know if anybody knows, but that's, I think, our next deep dive on this.
That's a good question. Somebody fought against Islam and they won because there is no more Ottoman Empire, so that's a good thing.
Okay, I'm getting kicked out of the chat room again. This just really irritates me. It keeps happening. I don't know who's doing this. I'm going to have to talk to my buddies at RJN and see if somebody's coming in on me.
Interesting.
Yep. Shoot. Okay, well, I'll figure that out in a minute.
Oh, Iggy is saying in the chat room that World War II broke it up. Ottomans fought with the Germans, or World War One.
Okay.
We'll have to do a show about that, about what happened to the Ottoman Empire. We should know that. It collapsed when the Russians capitulated. We're going to have to do a show about this. Inquiring minds want to know.
That's right. We'll try and make that part of part two or part three. That might be part three. So, let me go on. The consequences, and this is from Winston Churchill III, the consequences has been that the Wahhabis have been able to export their exceptionally intolerant brand of Islamic fundamentalism from Mauritania and Morocco on Africa's Atlantic shores through more than two dozen countries, including Bosnia, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East to as far afield as the Philippines and East Timor in the Pacific. This is the stark challenge that today confronts the Western world, and rightly so, he says, I fear it will be with us not just for a matter of years, but perhaps even for generations. Now, he goes on, and I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but let's see. Gravest of all, we should be handling a victory of gigantic proportions to our sworn enemies. Let no one imagine that by pulling out of Iraq, the threat will simply evaporate. This is 2006, folks. Wow. Pretty up-to-date, though, isn't it? On the contrary, it will redouble, it will come closer to home, and our enemies will have established in Iraq the very base that, by our defeat of the Taliban, we have denied them in Afghanistan. We shall see a desperately weakened United States with its armed forces undermined and demoralized increasingly at the mercy of our terrorist enemies. Well, a little bit of a prediction there, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is. They knew what they were talking about.
Yep.
We
are. Go ahead.
I don't know what I was going to say. I was busy trying to.
I can't walk into that movie. That's all right.
I cannot type and pay attention at the same time. Oh, my goodness.
That's all right. I almost forgot to start the show. So wow. He also talked back in 2006, says, in Iraq, the United States had lost at that time 2,200 men and women, Britain just over 100. Compare that to the first day of the Battle of Somme, 1 July 1916, when the British Army in a single day, before breakfast, lost 55,000 men killed, wounded, or missing in action. Wow. Did we talk of quitting? No. What has happened to the mighty United States? Is it going soft? Are the elected representatives of the American people ready to surrender to those who threaten their homeland? Indeed, their civilian population with death and destruction? I pray they are not. And I call to mind the words of my grandfather addressing the Canadian Parliament on New Year's Day, 1941, in which, referring to the British nation dwelling around the globe, but it applies equally to our American cousins today, when he declared, we are a tough and hardy people. This is Churchill the First. We have not traveled across the centuries, across the oceans, across the mountains, and across the prairies, because we're made of sugar candy. Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we are guilty of wanting people, you know, and a lot of our presidents have been guilty of that too, wanting to be liked too much. You know, we want people to like us, and we think, you know, just like in relationships, people think they can change each other. We think we can change the Middle East. No, you can't change the Middle East because you can't change Islam. You're trying to change something that people have believed in for a long time, and it's not going to happen. And you have to go down to the basics of good versus evil. Islam is from the devil, and we know there's going to be a monumental battle between the devil and Jesus one day on the Mount of Megiddo. So this isn't going to go away. This is coming to a head. All of this is coming to a head. And we do need politicians who speak out. That's one reason I like Louis Gohmert in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Because he does realize the threat of Islam, and he does speak against it. And as for what's going on now, Eliza, I'm not, you know, I look at what the policies have been. I look at what Bush Sr. and what Bush Jr., Jimmy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
How, I mean, after 9/11, 2001, what does George Bush do? He goes up there and says Islam is a religion of peace. He dedicates a mosque. So what I can't help wondering, and help me with this, is I cannot help wondering, this is one thing that goes through my head. I have no idea if I'm right or wrong. This is pure theory, pure speculation, but it's what I cannot help wondering about what's going on, is that Islam has defeated other nations by jihad, by violent jihad, because they could, because the people in those countries were weak, and maybe they had no weapons. They weren't America. Well, 2001 showed us that they can't get us violently, because what happened? I mean, America woke up right away. Everybody was patriotic. Everybody was talking about it. We were on fire. We said, hell no, you're not going to attack us. And we were on fire right after 2001. But what happened? We became complacent because different people, I mean, our politicians, the powers that be, they started feeding us this narrative that Islam was a religion of peace. You started seeing people on, you know, from CARE, different Muslims were getting out there on TV saying, no, Islam is... That actually, 9/11 2001 actually introduced Islam into America in a way that it shouldn't have even been able to. But the powers that be, the people that really control the world and what's going on, they allowed the narrative to be fed to us. And instead of standing up to it, we started accepting it. So what's going through my mind and what I question is, if Islam, we know Bible prophecy has to happen. We know God's word is going to happen no matter what. So if we're coming to the end of these last days and we're coming to the beginning of the rapture and the beginning of the tribulation, then certain things do have to happen. It's going to get worse before it gets better. We know this. So what I'm wondering is, since Islam figured out that it couldn't get us through violent means, because even though they are trying to take our guns away, they haven't taken them away yet. They sure are trying, though. So since Islam hasn't gotten us violently through violent jihad, they're winning the game with civilization jihad. Now, that brings me to Congress and the White House and these different politicians that seem to just lay down and take it and not speak out against it. Are they not speaking out because they're threatened? Because, I mean, if maybe Islam and the Islamists have decided that they have, I mean, they do have patience, that, okay, we'll take the time that it's going to take to wage civilization jihad. So go along with this, keep Obama in office, keep, you know, doing the rise of the Islamic caliphate, the Arab Spring, we're going to slowly let it rise. But Congress has to go along with Obama, and they can't, as much as he shouldn't be in the White House, Congress better go along with him, because if they don't, we're going to have suitcase nukes in every school in America. Is that what we're being threatened with? I mean, I don't know. But
I don't know.
Why hasn't Congress stood up to this?
Well, the other thing that I wanted to kind of avenue I wanted to take this down to is Sharia law and the American laws for American courts is kind of how I'm going to relate all of this. Because that's where I want people to start standing up and working with their Congress, with every single state. There's the four states that have passed it, but I want every state to start focusing. Now is the time in the new Congress to start working with your congressman to get this thing moving forward. And we've got Holger in the chat room. Let's bring him in for a minute, and then I want to play a thing from David Ural Shami. Hey, Holger, what's going on?
Good evening, ladies.
How are you?
Good evening.
Happy New Year.
Another excellent show you are putting on, so thank you.
Thank you. Well, you know, had me scared there last week when you were taking over my hour. I thought, oh, no.
Oh, yeah, no.
I'm just razzing you.
We could never replace you two, that's for sure.
Thanks.
Say, I just want to call in real quick because when you guys were touching on this whole, you know, the whole military thing and not fighting Churchill's comments there and so forth. And, yeah, I just wanted to, just as a reminder, and I'm not a military man. I know there's at least a couple in the chat room, so maybe they'll correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, from my standpoint, you know, we always talk about what the left in this country, the Marxists in this country, have done to try and subvert America. You know, we always talk about how they've focused on breaking up the family, unit. They've talked, you know, we've talked about how, you know, the public education system was basically set up to brainwash our children into a, you know, into a socialist mindset and so forth. They've attacked religion in our country. The, you know, it certainly was part of the deal with them. They knew they had to do something about the military, and so, you know, in my view, they've civilianized, you know, our military in America. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I am a firm believer in this separation of the military and the fact that we've got a civilian as a commander-in-chief. I agree totally with the founders making sure that's the case, so we don't have some sort of military junta, you know, running this country. But it stops there. And, you know, we literally haven't fought a war to win since World War II.
Right, I agree. And
so bottom line, as we've gone along in time here, we have let the civilian influence in our military become greater and greater and greater, to the point now where literally the military will not act unless whatever they plan passes some sort of PC test.
I know.
And you know, I think we have to keep that in mind because, you know, Lucha just mentioned the George Bush and, you know, calling it a religion of peace and so forth. I mean, here's a man who, quite frankly, in my mind, didn't believe that. George Bush didn't believe that Islam was a religion of peace. But the pressure was there. He had to check with these people and these people and these people, and they said, hey, you can't piss off a billion people. You got to call it this and all that kind of good stuff. So, I mean, that's what we're fighting against. And so it's not just Barack Obama and his stupid rules of engagement in Afghanistan. This has been going on for decades now. I mean, Bill Clinton wouldn't even fight a war with American troops. He had to make it a UN operation, for God's sakes.
Yep.
So,
no, I
you know,
agree.
I think that's an important point. When we won't, because of this PC attitude and the fact, if you ever listen to these retired generals talk about these operations against these Muslims, there is no give and take, man. They know who the enemy is, but yet the whole time that they were engaged in these battles, in these strategies and stuff, we never, ever had a commander-in-chief or the top brass in the military willing to say, we're at war with Islam.
Right.
It never happened, and of course it never will. So,
yeah, no, well, because they're too worried about getting reelected or making friends. And I'm absolutely with you. I totally agree that we've got I am so tired of the politically correct. I refuse to be politically correct anymore, and who knows where that'll go in 2013, but I'm tired of it. I won't do it anymore. And I'm tired of this whole diversity push that everybody's pushing as well.
Yeah.
No, look, we're in America, be an American. Period.
Yep.
You know? But,
and it's going to get just, I mean, it's only going to get worse. I mean, we've had the whole gay issue in the military now. We've all of this, you know, everything that happens you can trace back to this leftist movement in this country, and the fact that, you know, we've got people who have no experience at all in military or in warfare or in strategy or whatever that are basically calling the shots on how we operate in the field of operations.
You know what we need to do? We need to actually start forming our own Christian jihad, our own Christian civilization jihad. Probably not the right words for it, but that's the first thought that came to mind. It's like they're going to do their civilization jihad to us. We need to start doing the same and infiltrating every form of Islam there is and start preaching the Bible.
Well, I guess
that's the crusades, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, just call it the crusades, man.
That's the crusades, I guess. Yeah, my husband.
You know what I just thought of? You know what just crossed my mind, and this just now came to me, is I wonder how it would go. You know how some churches across the nation are letting Islamists come in, and they're doing this interfacing, and they're letting Muslims come in to so-called Christian churches. And, yeah. Well, I'm wondering if there are any in our particular areas that if we showed up at one of those churches and stood up, I mean, like if we were asking a question and we asked the Muslims at that were infiltrating the Christian church, if we just stood up as an innocent, observer, somebody in the pews, just stood up and asked them to their face, I have a question. Why would you allow our pastor to come and teach about Jesus at your mosque? Would love to be able to do that. Will you let us? And let them be put on the spot right there.
Well, actually, that's one of the things that I plan to do this next year. As soon as I'm going to start watching the local mosques and churches and their local newspapers and see when they're going to have this great and wonderful little interfaith event. Apparently, they had one this past year, but I missed it, or I would have been there. But that's the plan I've got for this year, is to start infiltrating some of these interfaith crap and just really start putting it, those kind of questions to them. Can you explain to us what jihad means? And then read it straight from the Reliance of the Traveler. When they lie to us, But let me get this back where I wanted to go with this is the whole American laws for American court. So with a little bit of the history, now I want to take it into the American laws for American courts and it kind of describe what Sharia is all about from the perspective of the legal. So I've got a recording here I want to play from David Yerushalmi, just to give you some guidance on that. But just in case there's somebody out there that doesn't know who that is, he's a lawyer who specializes in very complex litigation and risk analysis, and this is straight from his bio on the website, as it relates to geostrategic policy, national security, intellectual property. Oh, man, I need something in my tea, I think. International business relations, security law, disclosure and due diligence requirements for domestic and international concerns. And he has been involved in international legal and constitutional matters for over 27 years. He's today considered an expert on Islamic law and its intersection with Islamic terrorism, national security. In this capacity, he has published widely on the subject, including the principal critical scholarship of Sharia-compliant finance published in the Utah Law Review. So that's David Yerushalmi, excellent guy in terms of legal matters related to Sharia. Let me play this.
Since we've come to understand that Sharia as a legal doctrine and system is objective and knowable, certainly in the Muslim world, and we've also come to understand that it is an existential threat to our way of life. It calls for jihad. It calls for death to apostates. If a person wants to leave Islam, it is a capital crime. We've understood that if you blaspheme Muhammad, it is also a capital crime. Those are the laws applied in places like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, any place where Sharia exists. So if that is in fact the Sharia that is being applied in a state or federal court, then the answer has to be no. Sharia law should not apply here. That's no different from any other foreign law. Foreign laws that do not violate an individual's fundamental constitutional liberties, whether it's the state or federal constitution, should apply if it's appropriate. And it can be appropriate in several circumstances. If you get a foreign judgment and you want to come here and enforce that judgment, courts will generally enforce it, granted comity. If you have a contract that deals with foreign laws or a accident in a foreign country and you litigate in this country, the courts will quite rightly apply those foreign laws. And if you're involved in a contract dispute that requires litigation in a foreign country, or you get in an accident in a foreign country, courts in this country will quite rightly defer jurisdiction, they will not take the case, and have it litigated in the foreign country. However, there is a doctrine that all the courts apply at the federal level and in each of the states called void is against public policy. If those foreign laws, be they Sharia or the law of Timbuktu, violate fundamental public policy of the state or the federal government, then the courts will not apply it. Whether the parties agreed or not, the courts will simply refuse to apply it because it violates public policy. Now, what each of the courts have said is we need the legislature to tell us what public policy is. Because what we found, for example, in the area of Sharia, the Center for Security Policy, of which I am the general counsel, did a very important study where they examined all of the cases at the appellate level in the states that have published opinions where Sharia was raised as a defense or an offense or an aspect of the case. And we found that in 23 different states, the courts had applied at some level Sharia or rejected the application of Sharia. Unfortunately, without guidance from legislatures, the courts have gone back and forth. So sometimes they will look at Sharia and see that it is quite offensive to fundamental constitutional liberties, equal protection, due process, and have said, we're not going to apply Sharia. In other cases, the courts have ignored those threats. One of the more egregious cases occurred in Maryland, where a Pakistani woman had fled with her young son to avoid the oppressiveness of the Sharia system in Pakistan. The husband had obtained a divorce by simply announcing three times he wanted a divorce, a process not available to the woman under Sharia, and also obtained custody of the child in the Sharia court, primarily because the woman didn't show up to defend herself. When she argued her case in Maryland, because she initiated divorce proceedings and sought custody through the Maryland courts, she tried to explain to the Maryland courts that had she gone to Pakistan, now that she was living with another man, she would have been subject to capital punishment under Sharia for adultery. The Maryland Supreme Court, when it finally worked its way to the highest court of the state, understood the argument, accepted that that was in fact the case. The law of Pakistan included capital punishment for adultery, but because the court said we can't know that's going to happen to this woman, absolutely, we're going to ignore that. The end result was that this woman lost custody of her son. The courts applied Sharia through the jurisdiction of the Sharia courts. The state police power literally took her son away from her in Maryland based upon a Sharia law that would punish her with death for living with a man outside of a Sharia marriage. That is a wrong result that should have been corrected had the state had a bill or a legislation like our American Laws for American Courts.
Wow. Amazing that, you know, we don't have it as a federal law. That's the part that just, again, blows my mind. I get so angry at this that we were having to fight for this in every single state. My state does not have it. I am not one of those. Wish it did. Working very diligently with some folks to try and get it. Worked very hard on it last year, 2012. It got to the point where the chairman needed to bring it up for a vote, and he held it back at the end of the session. I was furious. One of the things with Sharia law and the way the courts are looking at it, as I was doing some digging on this, is they use something called comity. And it's not comity, laugh, laugh, ha, ha. It's spelled C-O-M-I-T-Y. Here's the definition of what that means when they use it in U.S. courts. Judicial comity law and legal definition. This is from a legal website I pulled it from. Judicial comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, is the respect shown by a court of one state to a court of another state. Well, they forgot to make that strictly a U.S. state, I guess. But anyway, sorry, let me go on. It is a legal principle used commonly in international law, generally through judicial comity. A court of one state shows reciprocity by giving effect to another court's laws and judicial decisions. Judicial comity also authenticates reasonable and good faith interpretations of existing precedents made by state courts. This helps in stimulating the state's interest in the finality of criminal convictions and fosters comity between federal and state courts. Federal-state judicial comity is ensured when a federal court shows high esteem or deference to state court decisions. And this is referencing a Newland versus Hall, yada, yada, through Circuit 11th Circuit, Georgia, 2008. Anyways, apparently that's what the judges are using to define what they think is right when in terms of Sharia law being used in the U.S. judicial courts. My interpretation of that? Bullshit. Excuse my French. Anyway. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. And I'll let Lucha, do you want to say a few words on it? Or?
Well, I'm looking at the definition of comedy, and I feel like I'm saying comedy, C-O-M-E-D-Y, but it you're right, it's C-O-M-I-T-Y, and it's important to note that they are talking about state legislatures, and it's with the states that they're talking about. I'll just read from this paragraph. Unfortunately, because state legislatures have generally not been explicit about what their public policy is relative to foreign laws, including, as an example, Sharia, the courts and the parties litigating in those courts are left to their own devices. First, to know what Sharia is, and second, to understand that granting comedy to a Sharia judgment may be at odds with our state and federal constitutional principles in the specific matters at issue. So the key here is to educate people, to educate our court systems, to educate our legislators. And that's what, you know, so many of us have been trying to do. I've sent emails about Sharia law and about the Muslim Brotherhood Manifesto to all my city council people, all the legislators. I have massive emailing lists with everybody on it. Do I know if they've read those emails? I have no idea. But we are trying to educate them. Yeah. And short of appearing in their office and making them themselves sign that they have seen it, you know, I don't know how we can ensure that they are getting this information, but we're doing, you know, what we can do. We're educating people, and the state legislators need to understand what Sharia law is. If they think, you know, say you have just a regular state legislator that's sitting in his office, and he's all caught up in the issues of the day and the issues of his constituency, and he really doesn't pay attention to Islam like, say, we do, then, you know, he may come across this, oh, well, this person wants to use this ruling. He has no idea what Sharia law is. Well, it's up to us, because we're the people that need to educate our legislators. It is up to us to educate them. They may be so tied up with all kinds of special interests, so it is up to us to educate them. And then it's up to them to enforce the laws of our Constitution as opposed to Sharia law or foreign law. And one thing that the four states that passed the American laws for American courts, it was Tennessee, Louisiana, Arizona, and Kansas. And one important thing to note is that it didn't pass in Oklahoma originally, because they specifically said Sharia law. Now, that case was a teachable moment, because to single out Sharia law, all, you know, there was a lot of cries about religious discrimination and against one religion, yada, 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 you know, much the same as this Organization of Islamic Cooperation wanting to, you know, the resolution 1618, making it a crime to criticize Islam. Well, they couldn't really write it making it a crime to criticize Islam, so they had to include all religions, just the same as this American Laws for American Courts has to include all foreign laws. You can't just single out Sharia like Oklahoma tried to, because people can jump on that. You know, I'm learning that. And I'm also learning that when you're fighting mosques in your neighborhood, I mean, me, I would want to go to my city council person and teach them all about Islam and say, this is why we don't want a mosque in our neighborhood, because it's going to indoctrinate our people to Islam, and this is the problem we have with Islam. But you can't do that. You can't fight it in that way. That's why this American laws for American courts is so important, because we have to go along with the legal system in order to win inside the legal system. So you can't go to your city council people and say, or your zoning board, and say, no, I don't want this mosque here, because they're going to indoctrinate a bunch of people into this violent so-called religion called Islam. No, you have to go along with the zoning things and how it'll cause too much traffic, yada, yada. And so why Oklahoma wasn't successful was because they singled out Sharia. Well, these states that passed American laws for American courts, they learned from that. And David Yerushalmi and Robert Muse of the American Freedom Law Center, those two guys are very, very, very good attorneys. David Yerushalmi, he's a Catholic attorney. Robert Muse, no, David Yerushalmi is a Jewish attorney, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, yep.
Robert Muse is a Catholic attorney. And so you have a Jew and a Catholic working together to fight Sharia law. And that is just one of the best things that I have ever heard. And these guys are good. These guys are out there on the forefront, and they have figured out that, you know, you can't single out just Sharia. You have to use foreign law and, you know, work within the system so that you can win, not so you can make a point, but so you can win. And that's one of the really good things about it.
Yep, I agree. And I put a link in the chat room for you to go out and sign a petition. There's also a very informative website. I'm going to pull that and put that in there as well. That's got a lot more detail to it. Also has a petition in it. I recommend you go out and sign that and read up on that website as well. This is a really good website for knowing a little bit more about American laws for American courts. Let's take a two-minute break here and just recognize a few folks in the chat room, and you do that really well. Lucha, I'll let you do that and welcome them tonight before I get too far into the show.
To our Blog Talk Radio family, everybody in the chat room and everybody listening that isn't in the chat room, a big shout-out to our folks, our wonderful people in the chat room. We've got Iggy, Eric from Iowa. We've got a couple guests. Holger Awakens, who's got his own awesome BTR show. Cal, a.k.a. Red Fox, who has her awesome BTR show. We've got Oz, haven't seen you in a while. And my sister, well, not my real sister, but my sister Trisha in Florida. Welcome. Thank you for being here. We love you guys so much.
Yep, I'm so glad you're here tonight. It was a rough start to the night. I forgot to dial in. And getting back into the swing of things again and back to work and all that good stuff. But hope everybody is starting off the new year with a fantastic start to 2013. We're going to continue this on. And let me go into a couple things. Those two websites I highly recommend. The one, where'd it go here? There was, okay, I've lost my article. I wanted to let everybody know about, oh, no, that's not it. See there? I need to be retrained. Why Muslims Hate America. I thought this was an interesting article to kind of go along with why we need to make sure we're doing American laws for American courts. I'm going to get back to that in a minute, but I wanted to get this in before the show ends. Again, I think some of this information is going to go into a part two. But this is from somebody that is a Muslim. He's an American Muslim activist. Can't quite tell what he's an activist for or against, but it was an article out on Reuters about why Muslims hate America. Well, shoot, they just hate everybody. They don't just hate America. But anyways, let me read a little bit of this. It might give a little insight. Many of age Americans remember September 11th. Yes. A day we justly cried out for freedom. Who's we? I don't think he did. But anyways, free speech. I'm putting a lot of my personal commentary, and I need to stop. Free speech and democracy. Fewer, however, remember September 11th, 1973, when America-backed dictator Augusto Pinochet's forces to overthrow and kill Chile's democratically elected president Salvador Allende. Okay, I didn't study history. I remember something of that, but I don't remember the details there. Let's see. Next thing he says is many of age Americans remember March 20th, 2003, the day America preemptively invaded and obliterated Iraq to unseat dictator Saddam Hussein while killing 100,000 Iraqi civilians. Well, I'll comment on that in a minute. Fewer, however, remember the December 1983 meeting between Donald Rumsfeld and Hussein, designed to emphasize America's, quote, close relationship with Iraq as an ally. The regime America destroyed in 2003, American tax dollars built two decades prior. few Americans remember that America long supported Libya's dictator Muammar Gaddafi, and we did, before citing democracy to wash our hands clean. We championed Egypt's dictator Hosni Mubarak before demanding his arrest and conviction. We supported Pakistan's dictator General Zia, who helped Talibanize Pakistan and was the brainchild of Pakistan's infamous blasphemy laws that suffocate free speech. A mysterious plane crash ended Zia's reign, robbing our State Department the opportunity to personally crucify him. Well, this is where I can't quite tell if he's for us or against us, but he goes on to talk about our image in many Muslim majority, and he talks our as if he's a true American, and I just have a real doubt in my mind. A lot of reasons why I'll go into in a minute. Our image in many Muslim majority nations is that a people who support dictators when convenient for oil and economic gain and overthrow them when not, all the while preaching the free speech, democracy, and freedom that we don't practice. But lest we be guilty of speaking in generalities, they who hate us still actually represent the vast majority of the Muslim world. Last June, several dozen Muslim leaders, this part I've got to do a deeper dive on too, representing numerous different Islamic organizations convened at a Capitol Hill summit, can we say Muslim in the White House, on Islam and world peace. Now, this is where he goes into some detail. His Holiness Hadrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad, head of the worldwide Ahmadiyya Muslim community, delivered the keynote address, after which the House passed a bipartisan resolution commending him for promoting, quote, individual and world peace and individual and world peace and individual and world justice, unquote. Wow. In the White House, promoting and passing this, Congressman, according to him anyways, need to validate some of this. Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia thanked Ahmed for supporting a special envoy to advocate for religious minorities in Middle East. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi remarked, quote, you spoke out on violence and tolerance, even among Muslims, because calling for the destruction of churches and synagogues is a violation of human rights. Really, Nancy? Really? No kidding. Likewise, Minnesota Congressman, well, there's no surprise here, Keith Ellison added, quote, we're honored by your presence. Under your leadership, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community has been a true blessing for us here in the United States, unquote. Makes me want to throw up. Sounds like you got a race course there. Anyway, so, Muslims in the White House, that's a show for another day as well. Frank Wolf surprises me on this one because he's one that stands out many times as well, and he's one of the signers of the Bachman Five. So that one surprises me that he participated in that, other than maybe to just be a fly on the wall, maybe. Maybe, maybe not. Yeah, Muslim idiot, I would agree, Eric. Yep, but if that's the reason they, well, look, like other countries aren't doing the exact same in terms of oil and all of that, but I want to recommend to everybody, please, get involved with your congressman. Get out there and understand what the laws are for American laws, for American courts. There are 10 American families and Sharia law that have actually, they have actually used Sharia law in the courts in the past couple of years. This is just amazing to me. 10 cases, 10 out of, what did the Center for Security Policy actually had 50 cases considered. And this is, I think, probably 2011, I think this was published by Frank Gaffney's group. 50 cases considered, 29 were rated highly irrelevant, highly relevant, meaning that upon legal review they were found to involve Sharia in a conflict of law with the constitutional principles or state public policy at the trial court or appellate court level. The remaining 21 cases were rated relevant, meaning that a significant element of Sharia law was involved at the trial court or appellate court level. In addition, we evaluated whether the trial court and appellate court decisions were Sharia compliant. Not Sharia compliant, intermediate or indeterminate, or not applicable. For example, a decision deemed to be Sharia compliant at the trial court level, and they put some codes on it. This study analyzes and discusses a total of 50 cases from 23 different states. 6 cases were found in New Jersey, 5 in California, 4 each in Florida, Massachusetts, and Washington, 3 each in Maryland, Texas, and Virginia, 2 each in Iowa, Louisiana, and Nebraska, and 1 each in Arizona, Arkansas, Delaware, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, New Hampshire, Ohio, and South Carolina. Lots of cases and lots of states that we all need to be active in. Arizona is one of them that passed it. What were the 4 states again, Lucha? It was Arizona, Iowa. I'm forgetting the states now that did pass
Tennessee,
it already.
Tennessee, Arizona. Oh, did I already? No, I've got it right here. Tennessee, Louisiana, Arizona, and Kansas are the states that have passed American laws for American courts.
Good, because some of those were mentioned here. So I think they passed.
But you have in Tennessee, you have Governor Bill Haslam, who I have a big beef with Walt Fitzpatrick's case. We're not going to go into that. That's a whole different thing. He's an American hero. But Governor Bill Haslam is appointing Sharia people in his administration. He's using Sharia financing. So even though Tennessee did pass this American Laws for American Courts, it does have a lot of Islamic problems, and the governor is a big part of it. Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee is not a good guy. He's advancing it.
Haslam, H-A-S-L-A-M?
Haslam, yes.
Almost sounds Islamic in its name. Wonder what background he is. That's another show too, isn't it?
Well, the Tennessee court systems, from what Walt has gone through, the Tennessee court systems are so corrupt and so out there. They've been operating illegally for 28 years. That's what you have in Tennessee.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, there is a lot of that. I've got some relatives in Tennessee, and I could tell you stories. Man, they do believe in taking care of their own sometimes, but, yeah, they do have problems. And, again, it all comes back to the whole politically correct crap that everybody's got to be voted back in, you know? And, I mean, look at all of the – Holger brought it up, the religion of peace, so-called, because of being politically correct. Go out to religion of peace and just see what they've done. There's a picture of a young boy. This religion of peace racked up 11,267 dead bodies in 2,459 barbaric terror attacks during 2012. A little Nigerian child that's pictured here was in the wrong place at the wrong time. How dare him being there? Shows a picture of him with a bloody head. Guess where he was at? He was at church on a Sunday morning. Unbelievable. How many churches are being blown up? How many Christians are being killed? All in the name of a religion of peace. Again,
exactly.
Not a religion.
Well, they think they get away with calling it a religion of peace because to them, peace is when all are in submission to Islam. That's how they justify calling it a religion of peace. I love Twitter. And I love having conversations with people. And I do, you know, I come across some interesting people. And I've learned quite a bit from them, from those who are willing to talk. And I've learned a lot just by talking to Muslims on Twitter, believe it or not. It's weird, but it's true. But on the other hand, you know who Hassan Shibli is?
Yes.
the chair guy in Florida?
I've met him. Oh, yeah. Yep, I've met him.
Oh, girl, I tried to get him to debate me. You know what he told me? He told me to send him my resume. I needed to have qualifications before he would debate me.
Yeah, he was at the ISNA conference in Tampa, and we were there. We were there to infiltrate, but go ahead. He's not a nice guy. He's not a nice guy. There's a
anyone that is trying to promote Sharia isn't.
There's a New Jersey imam that's now trying to get disregard the First Amendment and replace it with Sharia law. Yeah, that ain't going to happen. But who knows, New Jersey? Let me think. Who's the governor of New Jersey? What's that big guy's name?
Oh, Mr. Islamist? Yes.
Oh, yeah. Do you think?
Christie.
Oh, yeah. That's his name.
Gee. You mean
God,
that guy who had
maybe
Obama over for a big photo op?
Yeah. Let me guess.
Wow.
Probably this guy's working with him. What do you want to bet behind the scenes? All he's got is, let's see, this is Mohammed Qatanani. Qatanani, an imam of one of the largest mosques in New Jersey, has declared that anyone criticizing Islam is a direct threat to our national security. To our national security, excuse me, he believes that, quote, and I'm quoting him here, America should disregard its First Amendment and instead act in accordance with Sharia law for the ultimate, inside quote, good of society, unquote. Let me guess, did he take it before Christie? Anyways, therefore, anyone suspected of speaking negatively of Islam or the Prophet Muhammad should be investigated by the Department of Homeland Security. But, of course, if you want to cheer for the complete annihilation of Israel, I'm sure that would be allowed. No kidding. I think we all should go to New Jersey and have a radio jihad show there. What do you think? Maybe a whole day of radio jihad shows. There are religions that promote turning the other cheek even when mocked, but it appears Islam is not one of them, really. According to one of the most prominent imams in North America, Islam never condones violence, but it also, under no uncertain terms, ever accept speaking ill of the Prophet Muhammad. Nicely said. Do not speak about Islam, because that means death. Do not speak about the Prophet Muhammad without saying peace be upon him. You know, they could say, this Reliance of the Traveler could probably be about 30 pages, but it's like 800 and something. No, it's 1,000 and something pages if they just left out peace be upon him every time they said the Prophet.
Muhammad, 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 Muhammad. Peace not be upon him. Do you ever wonder why they have to say peace be upon him? It's because in Islam you're not guaranteed of heaven. Even they say peace be upon him every time because they don't even know if he's in heaven. Because heaven is not guaranteed to anybody. Even if you're a martyr, it's still not guaranteed if you're going to go to heaven in Islam or not. And, you know, I don't know how Muslims can be okay with that. Heaven, even if you're a pious Muslim, if you do your five prayers a day, if you do your zakat and you go to the Hajj and all the stuff that Muslims are supposed to do, even if you're a care guy waging jihad in the U.S. or beheading Christians in Nigeria, even if you're such a good Muslim doing those things,
and that
you're still
like
not guaranteed
fun
of heaven.
Yeah. Well, women never go to heaven, of course, and men are the only ones that go to heaven to get 72 virgins. But like I said before, let's see, no women in heaven but 72 virgins. Nobody
I
thinks
know
about that logic, do they?
I don't know. Maybe they're virgin camels or something. I don't know.
There you go. Virgin camels or more boys.
There's quite a bit in the Quran that is not explainable. It just doesn't make sense. Any which way you try to put it, it really does not make sense. It just doesn't make sense. I don't know how it's written you know, when I read it, I checked it out from the library. I wasn't willing to spend money on one, but I did check one out from the library, and I read it. It was one of the most, it was the most depressing book I have ever read. And in the notes that they have, you know, they have the surahs, and then in the on the bottom half of each page, they have notes that they're, you know, I mean, I call them indoctrination notes. So they have their little study notes in the bottom half of each page in the Quran. And the hatred of Jewish people is like, you know, they view as really bad guys who are just the people to hate and behead and be against. Christians are simply those who have gone astray. But for some reason, they really hate the Jewish people. And, you know, we're infidels to them, we're unbelievers to them, and we're worthy of death to them. And if we ever had the Islamic caliphate here, I mean, the rights of non-Muslims in Islamic states, you were talking about Sharia's. Well, some of the laws are that you are, if you're a non-Muslim, a Christian or a Jew specifically, because the other ones, they generally kill. And if you're a Christian or a Jew, lucky enough to be living in a non-Muslim state, then you have to pay the jizya, which is the poll tax. You're not allowed to build new churches, temples, or synagogues. You're not allowed to pray or read your sacred book out loud at home or in churches. Dhimmis are not allowed to print their religious books or sell them in public places and markets. We wouldn't be allowed to install the cross in our houses or churches since it is a symbol of infidelity. You can't, I mean, there's so much that you can't do, and it's crazy. That's what Sharia law is. That's what would happen to America if it came here, and that's why education is so darn important. And educating our new, you know, I'd be happy if we can just fire all of Congress, fire the White House, hire all citizen legislators, congressmen and senators, and start from scratch and have them all be educated on the things we need them educated on, like the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Quran and Sharia law. And if they're educated in just those four things, then they've got a good darn start, dang it.
Absolutely. Let me leave you with one final reading from the treasured book of Reliance of the Traveler. When you mentioned that they are so angry, here's joking, R19-0, okay? Excessive joking is blameworthy and forbidden since it eliminates one's dignity and reserve and creates resentment in certain situations and people. It also causes immoderate laughter, which kills the heart. The Prophet, Allah bless him and give him peace, said to his companions, what? That's why these people don't have a smile on their face. There is not an Islam person that can laugh, can smile, can have a good time, can enjoy life, can know anything positive other than hatred. Wow. Lots of information there, guys, but this was all really relating to American laws for American courts. That is a huge driver for me this year, 2013. I got involved with it too late in 2012. I plan to make sure that my congressman, my state congressman, understand that this is a critical component this year. We've got some good guys that are for it. You'll see a list on that website, that last website I gave you, that shows a lot of supporters on it. Please go out and check it out and join us in this fight. And I'll let you run down the show. You do that so much better. Thanks, everybody, for joining. Have a great start to 2013. Stay safe, and we will see you next week. Go ahead, Lucha. I'll let you close it out.
We love you guys here in the chat room. We love y'all listening. We're so happy that you joined us. We've got Iggy, Eric from Iowa, a guest, Holger Awakens, Kel, a.k.a. Red Fox, Mother Goose joined us, and Oz joined us. Thank you for joining us. Trisha, I love you, girlfriend, and we love you all. Thank you so much for being here, and God bless you, and we'll see you next week.
Amen. God bless everybody, and let's talk about it.
Come from the cities and they come from the smaller towns. Beat up cars with the tires and drummers go and crack, boom, bam.
ROTK in the USA, ROTK in the USA. bread. With the problems in her head and very little money in her hand. Some are black and some are white, and they ain't too proud to sleep on the floor tonight. Blind faith in Jesus, you know that faith is mine. Rockin' in the USA. Some going, boy.